Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. Actor Bertie Carvel won a Tony Award for Featured Actor in a Play earlier this month for his portrayal of Rupert Murdoch in the Broadway play, Inc. It's currently playing at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater, but only through this Sunday, July 7th. The setting is London in the late 1960s. Back then, there were a handful of newspapers on Fleet Street vying for readership: The Mirror, The Telegraph, The Guardian, and The Mail. In 1969, enter a young Rupert Murdoch. He purchased a failing tabloid paper called The Sun, and Murdoch had a goal: to disrupt the existing newspaper ecosystem. Today, The Sun is among the highest-selling papers in London, but did its rise to the top come at a cost to journalism and to the culture? I talked to Bertie Carvel recently about the show and his portrayal of Rupert Murdoch. We began talking about where Murdoch was in his life when we first meet him in Inc.
He's just turned 38. He's successfully disrupted the kind of media landscape in Australia, where he's obviously a native Australian. Bought the News of the World in London, which is his kind of first foothold in the London media, and has bigger plans. So here's a young man with big ideas, but regarded very much in every way as an outsider in the hidebound British world. I think there's an element of the disruption that maybe comes from a good business sense, and possibly an element that comes from, you know, sticking two fingers up to the establishment.
How does he feel about being an outsider?
Well, listen, I have to plead the fifth a little bit, because I can't speak with any authority about how Mr. Murdoch feels.
How does your Murdoch feel? How about the
yes,
Murdoch
I'm playing
you play
the character
on stage?
Rupert Murdoch. And I suppose that is my job, isn't it? Is to imagine. I think what's so interesting about playing, you know, making drama about real events is that I think drama can do something that journalism can't, which is that it's allowed to use its imagination. And I suppose as a journalist, you're not meant to fill in the blanks in that way, or at least you need to sort of show your workings. And what we're allowed to do is use imagination and empathy, and to get into rooms that one could doesn't have access to. How does he feel? I think he feels excited, in both senses of the word. I think he feels upset by the... I think there's a sort of irony, actually, that he is somebody who is as close to being a kind of blue-blooded Australian as you can get. You know, his father, Knight of the Realm, extremely successful businessman, very wealthy, well-to-do family, educated at Oxford and Geelong Grammar, which is a sort of, you know, colonial public school. And the idea that such a man should be regarded by the British elite as an outsider has a sort of whiff of ridiculousness to it. But of course, he's not British. And so I think there is an element of bitterness and anger there and upset. I mean, I'm not sure if that's fair. I'm having met him briefly on a couple of occasions now, I'm actually not sure that, I'm not sure how deep those wounds do go. He seems like somebody with a relatively stable sense of himself. Anyway, it's useful for the drama to imagine that here's somebody with a kind of personal as well as intellectual kind of vendetta. And I think the two things kind of align quite neatly.
He came to see the show. Rupert Murdoch came to see
the
show.
We came in London at the end of our run in the West End, which I thought was a weird thing to do, given that, you know, he'd sort of lived the events firsthand. But I suppose curiosity killed the cat, and lots of his lieutenants had been, and, you know, practically everybody who ever worked on Fleet Street came when we were at the Almeida, first of all. And so I guess he'd heard that it was a good night at the theatre, and then he came back and saw it on Broadway. Obviously he lives here much of the time, so it was perhaps less far to go, and came with Rebecca Brooks, who used to be editor of the News of the World, I think, before it closed, and now is occupies an august position in his organization, and practically every living editor of the Sun newspaper. So that was an intimidating evening for me in the theater.
When does word come to you? When do they tell you that he's in the audience?
The first time round, Rupert Gould, our director, came kind of bouncing into my dressing room about 5 minutes before the show started with a huge grin on his face. And I sort of pretty much knew what was up from the grin, but he said, "Do you want to know who's in?" And I said, "I think I do know, Rupert, I can tell." And this time round, I just got an email from maybe it was Rupert again, saying, "Do you want to know when he's coming?" One had heard, you know, on the grapevine that he was going to come, and you know, everybody's welcome. The more the merrier. Please buy tickets.
The name of the show is Ink, and my guest is Bertie Carvel. Carvel, I'm saying it correctly?
Carvel, yeah, Ink. Rhymes with Marvel.
Oh, excellent. Bertie Carvel, I love a good mnemonic device. When I was so excited to hear your real speaking voice, you have this sort of lovely, plummy, deep accent, because the voice that you have as Rupert Murdoch, I'm so curious about the work you did with your dialect coach. Is Ben Fury?
Yes, Ben here, and I originated the role back home, so yeah. I sort of did a lot of the work in my bedroom. Mainly, actually, I listened to a recording, which I've got a sneaking sense you might be about to play me, but there's the one that I found and loved was an interview from 1968, where he's interviewed about his plans, and not least because, you know, in his eyes, I think the answer to your earlier question, you know, what was he feeling around that time? And it's a very specific accent, both the Adelaide accent being specific and a sense of the period, and the fact that here's somebody living in the midst of the British establishment. So all of those things are heard there. And, you know, I tried to be as accurate as I could. But I think as well, at a certain point, I realized that unlike journalists, accuracy wasn't, you know, it's important to me, but it's not the goal. I think the most important thing is to kind of serve the play. And I think what James is doing is not just a history lesson about what happened on Fleet Street in a given year, but actually he's using that frame to make us, you know, ask us, invite us to have a dialogue with the present. So actually, the most important thing is to be kind of interesting and to serve the rhythms of James's text, which don't necessarily mean, you know, being a slave to the kind of patterns of speech of, you know, I thought long and hard about trying to, he's quite, I wouldn't call him taciturn, but he's quite a considered speaker, particularly when interviewed. And there is an interview in the play, there's an interview scene at the beginning of the act two in the play. And I noticed that he is quite considered and measured when he's speaking in that context. I mean, perhaps when he's giving someone both barrels in the back office, it's a different story. And I thought about, you know, trying to bring that into the performance, and tried it out a bit in rehearsals, and it wasn't that useful, actually. It seemed to get in the way of the musicality of what James has written, which is very fluent and fluid and includes a lot of the kind of mannerism. You know, he sort of writes for you the ums and ahs, and, you know, he's one of those writers who kind of builds that in. So at the end of the day, I felt like I'd sort of do all my homework and then throw it away and then just kind of take a run at it.
But the silences are really important too.
Always, yeah. And well, I think acting is, for me, is incredibly musical, and you know, silence is part of music, isn't it? It's as important as sound, and yeah, rhythm and tempo, I think, are two things that I have to be careful, actually, not to get too stuck sometimes in a rhythm or a tempo, because I feel it very keenly, and I think it can have an incredibly deep impact on an audience. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a kind of often a right way to say a line, but you have to be careful not to get stuck in a kind of like a sort of phonograph of your own performance, and actually to remain alive, because the most exciting thing is when somebody alights as it were, for the first time on the right way of saying something. It's what, you know, so often one's striving to get back to the kind of electricity that you felt in a rehearsal room, because the first time you discover the thought on the line is electric. And then the great trick, I think, in the theatre is to kind of preserve or reanimate that moment of inspiration and to give it the sense that it's happening in the present tense, and not that it's been, you know, a copy of something you decided was the right way of doing it in rehearsal. So I think for somebody who, like me, who has quite a musical sort of sensibility, the danger can be that you're kind of you've sort of somehow recorded your performance in your imagination, and that you're sort of copying it and rolling it out, and the challenge is to remain completely present each time. And sort of, and I think that's about a kind of sense of like identifying what it felt like, you know. And I think it is quite useful to think of this kind of recording. I feel like you have a black box, like they have on airplanes, and that sort of records your and what happens to me is, in rehearsal, I'll discover something that felt exciting and confirm it with the director that it was exciting. And then somehow you hope that the black box has kind of recorded where that came from. And it's not necessarily recorded in any articulate way, but there's a sensation of like, oh, I sort of go there now. And I think one can get back to that sensation, and then what comes out each time feels fresh. Whereas if you are simply recording the thing that came out and not the sensation of the inspiration, then maybe you're doing a kind of, what, you know, phoning it in.
Or self-imitation.
A self-imitation, exactly. And I, to be quite honest with you, I mean, I don't know any actor who could not do that. I've done this play over 250 times now, and of course, you know, you get to the limits of reinventing it, and then you have to repeat yourself, and that's the job. I mean, the job is to do the same thing every night, and it drives you a bit mad sometimes. So I think that, you know, one has to make one's peace with that. And anyway, I'm digressing massively. Please shut me up.
My guest is Bertie Carvel. The name of the play is Ink, and he plays Rupert Murdoch. I do want to get to that tape of Rupert Murdoch.
I'd love to hear it.
A young Rupert Murdoch. Here he is talking a little bit about his vision and version of what the press is about.
Do you like the feeling of power you have as a newspaper proprietor, of being able to sort of formulate policies for a large number of newspapers in every state of Australia?
Well, there's only one honest answer to that, of course, and that's yes. Of course one enjoys the feeling of power. Although, if I can just hold you there for a minute, I think that this question of the power of newspaper proprietors can be greatly overdone. We have more responsibility than power, I think. The newspaper can create great controversies, stir up arguments within the community, discussion, can throw light on injustices, just as it can do the opposite. It can hide things and be a great power for evil.
It's not a perfect system, obviously, but can you think of a better one?
Can you think of a better one? I can hear that after listening to your answer about the musicality. I can hear the rhythm pattern that you picked up from him.
That's right. And I think, you know, I notice in those, I mean, I do the same thing myself in interviews, that it's almost as though you can see him saying something in his head and deciding whether it's a good idea before he goes on. And he has the good sense to do that in silence, whereas I just witter on while I'm trying to decide whether what I have to say is worth saying. So I apologize for that. I apologize to your listeners. But yeah, there's a sort of measured thing. And, you know, of course, most of the play takes place in private. And I'm not sure that cadence would appear in that setting.
I'm going to ask you to do this. I'm just going to ask you to say...
Well, there's only one answer to that, of course, and that's yes. Of course, one enjoys the feeling of power and more responsibility than power, I think. A newspaper can stir up arguments within the community and discussion, just as it can do the opposite and be a great power for evil, something like that.
That was spooky. Can I talk about your physicality on stage?
Yeah.
Because I was trying to figure out how to describe it to our listeners, and it reminded me a little bit of Richard Nixon.
Right.
where your head is jutted forward a bit and your back is a little bit of an S. You're tall and your hands are often in your pockets. One, being in that position all night, is that difficult to maintain? I mean, he really has a figure. You really strike a figure.
Yeah. I was doing more yoga when I was doing the play in London than I am at the moment. I've definitely noticed the absence of the yoga. I suppose it does have an impact. To be honest with you, I don't really know where that stuff comes from, except that I do sort of spend time looking at the subject, I suppose, of my imitation, and thinking about, you know, spend a long time thinking about little tricks we could do to give the impression that I resemble him. So I've, you know, played some of those tricks and I'll keep them to myself, but you know, little kind of, but then most of it, I think, just comes from the sense of like, what does it feel like to be in this person's body, and then that somehow expresses itself externally. So it's not like I sort of thought, oh well, he should be stooped or his head should jut forward. I didn't really do that consciously. It sort of arrived out of a sense of like, you know, what shape does this guy feel like he's in? Do you know what I mean?
The word shape is right.
Yeah, but it's an internal shape for me, and then it expresses itself physically, and I find that exciting. You know, that's what's great about acting, is that you act with every part of yourself, and the one thing is not disconnected from the other for me. You know, so the sort of feeling and the inner world comes out, expresses itself physically, and that's all part of the joy of it, really, and part of your toolkit.
Are the audiences different in New York? Are the reactions different than in London? I'm guessing there's also sort of a London, a British Australian subtext when it plays in London that maybe we New Yorkers aren't getting.
Well, I'd have to say yes. Of course, it's different, and I think that
what's different, I guess, is the better question.
That's a question I'm not so comfortable with the answer to. I don't know. I mean, you know, clearly there are sort of cultural reference points that are not shared, and so I think the huge difference is that what the sun means to Londoners is iconic and instant, and you know, people have a point of view about what they think about the sun, which I don't think is true here. I don't think people have really, by and large, even heard of the sun newspaper here. So part of the magic trick in London is getting people who think they know. Even before we've started, we're disrupting people's expectations. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of meta theatre in that, you know, and you're getting people. We open the play at the Almeida Theatre in North London, which has a sort of loyal and, by and large, I would imagine, quite sort of, you know, you might call its audience the liberal elite, for example. And so to get those people by the end of Act One to be rooting for Rupert Murdoch is in itself kind of enjoyable. And it's weirdly enjoyable for them. There's a sort of guilty pleasure, I think. But what's underneath all of that is that James is inviting those people maybe to sort of cross the floor and think from a different point of view. And then Act Two takes things in a different direction. Here, we don't start with those assumptions. But what is true of a New York audience is that it thinks very deeply. So I think instantly the resonance, the kind of the harmonic level that goes across to, you know, Rupert Murdoch is a disruptor. This is a play about somebody who upends the status quo. And you don't have to think very hard to look across for a sort of present tense analogy in your country, and I think that resonance is very powerful here, much more so than back home. And I mean, I asked myself the question when they first started talking about bringing the show here. I thought, well, is it going to go off the boil, you know, in the 12 months it'll take us to sort of, you know, get the production, come here, rehearse it, blah blah blah. And if anything, it's only become
absolutely
more sonorous and resonant here because of what's going on. So I think that speaks very loudly. So it is different, but no less kind of urgent, I think.
My guest is Bertie Carvel. We're talking about his role as Rupert Murdoch in the Tony-nominated play, Ink. It is so interesting. It's a play, but is very much directed like a musical. in some ways. I mean, they really get that sense of their synchronized performance, and there's parts of it that are broad, even though a lot of it, a lot of the conversations between Rupert and Larry Lamb are sort of big but intimate.
Yeah, I a couple of things about this. And Rupert Gould, the director, I mean, his work often involves movement and choreography and is sort of dynamic in that way, and this is no exception. He's a great showman. But he was also conscious, I think, of trying to create, give the form of the play a sense of being a tabloid, you know, so that even in its staging there is an element of what The Sun is famous for doing, which is over the top, kind of brassy, bold, in your face. And so he wanted the production to feel that way, and I think he succeeded in that regard. James's writing is incredibly, it has a rhythm to it. It's sort of like music hall in a way, I think, you know. And so there is an element of, with the kind of Lamb murder, or certainly the opening sequence, this amazing scene in the prologue, which takes place in the script James gives us. He just says darkness at first, and then you hear these two voices talking, and Rupert staged it like a kind of front cloth, you know, Eric and Ernie, or sort of Morecambe and Wise, sort of double act, as it were, before we then find ourselves into a more naturalistic setting. But so he's kind of lent into those elements, and the fluidity, you know, the scenes are fast paced, the scenes of half a page tumbling into one another. So he had to find staging solutions. Incredible set Barney Christie's designed, with desks piled high. Like, you know, my father's a journalist, and I remember from his office.
Barry, the lead? Your father's a journalist?
My father, his father, and his father were all journalists.
So, you tell me that in the last 2 minutes,
right,
of the interview?
Well, you didn't know that. Oh, I feel like I've told the whole world this story. I'm the one that got away. So maybe there's some kind of weird homecoming for me coming in. Some sort of strange psychoanalytic reading of my choice to play Rupert Murdoch.
Did you take in things, because of by osmosis, about journalism that you've used?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the things that sort of I find so fascinating about this play, as you said in your brilliant introduction. You know, I think one of the many things that this play is thinking about is the responsibility journalism has to the truth. I've been thinking quite a lot about my responsibility as an artist to the truth, and the ways in which that intersects. And when people ask me questions about, you know, how did you play, what research did you do, and, you know, sort of terrifying, the idea that you might be found out to be less than the real thing. And actually quite a lot of my thinking around this play has been about my responsibility to the man Rupert Murdoch. And, you know, ought I to have tried to meet him? I decided not to in rehearsal, and didn't think he'd want to anyway, but I actually decided that it was I was more likely to get at the truth by maintaining using my imagination, because that's my tool, rather than sort of somehow thinking that if I sat with him for 20 minutes or half an hour that I'd approach a sense of the man in a different way.
My guest has been Bertie Carvel. The name of the play is Ink. It is currently on Broadway. It was a pleasure having you here.
It's a pleasure being here. I need to learn to speak in shorter sentences. Don't I?
Please don't learn to speak in shorter sentences. This is why we're on public radio,
Bertie. I need
to
be a bit more like The Sun.
This is All of It on WNYC.